see more equitable.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. I realize that this repeats itself. Your wife shouldn't see reading. How much you're taking? Okay. Rishus, the Rosh Hakolel, and Meir Rabosai, ladies and gentlemen, cherished colleagues, it's for me a really big honor to speak for such a very distinguished Makom Torah as the Kollel of North Miami Beach. I seem privileged to learn here a few minutes today. And tonight there's a very festive mood, which is legitimate. This is our celebration of the B'nai Torah. Chanukah is our victory celebration. And I want to tell you a story. It's a long story, not that long, that connects all of this together. And we're going to the turn of the century, and I don't mean 13 years ago. I don't know how to do this equitably, but I don't know how to do this. All right, I'll fall off in a minute. And at that time, we're talking Galicia, Poland, which is extremely Hasidish. And the boys would go with their fathers Erev Yontif. They'd line up the train stations to go to the Rebbe's. And the girls went to Polish public school. They were intrigued by Polish novels, enthralled by Polish society. It's me. Sausage eat sausage. And the boys had a glimmer in their eye. There was a gleam, there was a sparkle. They were dynamically involved in Yiddishkeit. But the girls, when the boys went out for Yontif, the mothers would take their daughters to shul. These are from Hasidic homes with braided pigtails, bulletproof stockings. And they couldn't take it, felt totally penned in and restricted. And they ran away with their boyfriends to the big cities, and they never returned. And there was hardly a home that wasn't impacted. And there's a woman, and to maintain a sense of drama, I'm not yet revealing her name. And she had the advantage that she was a dressmaker. And the metaphor jumped up at her that there was a rip in the fabric of the Jewish people, and that unless it was mended immediately, become irrevocable and irreparable. And she had this idea. Now you'd say to yourself, if the boys are going to yeshiva, and the girls are going to Polish public school, give them a Jewish education. However, and yet, on the mindset of the Hasidim of Galicia, the idea of girls having a Jewish education, by way of analogy, there's a man who's walking down the street in Yerushalayim, and he met a woman, a Ger Hasidista, and two blocks later, he met her husband. He said, you know, I just met your wife two blocks ago. He said, I know. We're taking a walk together. So the mindset of the Hasidim in Galicia, to give girls Torah education, it was unthinkable. And she had this plan, which she was about to launch, and then World War I broke out. I teach a lot, and I often say things that are amusing to my students, but then I think of something more amusing to entertain myself. But the one that's occurred to me is so good, I'm going to share with you. I just thought to myself, could you imagine how depressing it would have been to call it World War I at the time? They called it the Great War. Okay, anyways, no, depressing to call it World War I. So World War I broke out, and she and her family, they are devout, Belzer Hasidim, flee war-torn Krakow, Galicia, to the relative safety of Vienna. And they go from alley to alley without a roof over their heads, sleeping under the stars, until they finally find a dank apartment in the 6th district of Vienna. And here I can show off a little bit. I was born and raised in Vienna. It was the first of districts that were the religious ones. When I was a little boy, I'm 27, when I was a little boy, an elderly man told me that in the 2nd district of Vienna, on a Friday night, there were oceans of black coming and going from the Shtiblach. All of that, of course, was an island. So there they find an apartment in the 6th Bezirk. And our heroine is determined that on Shabbos, like every Shabbos, she's going to walk to shul, which means a long, grueling trek in the midst of the winter where there are snowdrifts tall enough to bury fire engines all the way to the 1st District. And yet, of all unlikely people, her Catholic landlord informs her that right there in the 6th Bezirk, in the 6th District, is an Orthodoxische, is a religious synagogue. She's so excited. She walks in that Shabbos, and here's the first of our segues, the Shabbos Chanukah. And the Rav gets up to speak, and she's like, huh? Who's this imposter? There's a man with a brushed fedora, a short jacket, a trim goatee, polished shoes. Where she comes from Galicia, the rabbis have langa regalach, the bulletproof stockings, untrimmed beards, hats large enough to be a shayla of ohel. Who's this imposter? No, no, he's one of us. His name is Rabbi Dr. Moshe Fleisch, a disciple of Rabbi Shamsha Vol Hirsch. And he gets up and he thunders. Now, I'm sure you've heard the term of a fire and brimstone sermon, but I'm quite certain there's no one here in this room who's heard one. And the reason you've never heard one is the preacher gets up and says, you're going to burn, you're going to burn, you're going to burn, you're going to burn. He doesn't say who he's talking about, but everyone knows. Everyone knows. You're going to burn, you're going to burn. And when he finishes, the very person that he was addressing goes over and says, Rabbi, good talk. They really need to hear it. So what's the point? But the great people, and that's you and you, and certainly you and you and you and you, realize that he and she, there my wife's expecting, we always call the baby Heshi. Later, Heshi assumes its identity. But the great people realize that he or she is talking to me. And he says, everyone here can be Yehudis. She was the heroine of Hanukkah, the one who sacrificed. And he's talking to me. Hold on, sure. Actually, the Rav Rabbi Soloveitchik once spoke in Rutgers, and the microphone was placed under his beard. And after an hour, he spoke, he was a very protracted speaker. After an hour, three quarters, they said, we don't hear you. He said, all right, I'll go back to the beginning. Don't worry. Everyone here can be Yehudis and go out and save our people. And she says, he's talking to me. I can save my people. I can save the girls of Krakow, indeed in Poland, of the world at large. And she writes down after Shabbos what he wrote. And she made it her business to attend every drasha that he gave, every single lecture. And albeit by nature, she's an exceptionally modest woman. And to maintain that sense of drama, I've not yet revealed her name. And one time, she decides she has to present her notes to Rabbi Dr. Moshe Fleisch. Her fear is that if she's not accurate in what she's transcribing, then there'll be an inaccuracy in the Masora. And the chain is as strong as the weakest link, and we can't afford anything which is inaccurate. So she musters the courage. She goes for Rabbi Dr. Moshe Fleisch. She presents her notes, and he's amazed, agog, a twitter. Slackjaw. Like a stenographer. She hasn't missed a word. And then she says, what must I read? And he tells her, you must read the books of Rabbi Shamsha Vol Hirsch, of Marcus Lehman, Hanoch Te. And the catch was that she had no money. And she forgoed her groschen to buy herself a lunch and saved that money to buy the books of Rabbi Shamsha Vol Hirsch. And she mastered them. And the war is over. This time of year again, she turns to Krakow. And she puts up a sign in a dressmaker shop that in honor of Hanukkah, there's going to be a sale. And all the mothers and daughters are looking in the mirror, clucking away, seeing how the skirt falls and how the blouse fits. And she's appalled. They may be at haute couture, but inside they're spiritual tatters. And then she does something which I can describe to you. Indeed, I will. And she does something which I can even act out for you. Indeed, I will. But you'll never believe me. And she lifts aloft a ribbon and says, who wants a ribbon to tie their hair? And all the hands go up like a forest. I do, I do, I do, I do. Now, I'm involved in education. You offer a student today a ribbon to tie their hair. At best, you will elicit a yawn. If you don't offer a cell phone, driving lessons, trip to Disney, and a spending spree in the Gap, who even listens to a teacher? A ribbon to tie their hair? But the thing which drove Polish Jewry was grinding poverty. The average Polish Jew never even tasted milchiks. The closest they got was a cup of water, put a few drops of milk inside to make it cloudy. And a girl had one dress, weekday Shabbos. She got taller, they added a hem. Taller, yet another hem, and another hem, and another hem. And you'd almost tell her age, like you count the tree by counting the rims. And you had one pair of shoes, weekday Shabbos. The toe came out, a patch. The heel broke, a patch. The sole broke, another patch. Bulbous appendages. Who wants a ribbon to tie their hair? I do. Whoever can answer this question will win the ribbon. Who was Yehudas? Absolute, total silence. Finally, one mother in a barely audible tone, just a whisper, said, Yehudas? Yehudas? This sounds Jewish. Do you want to know about the apostles, Christological figures? That we know. Jewish stuff, go ask the boys. Why is that? I don't know. What would you like to learn? Yes. Then come to my dressmaker shop the first night of Hanukkah. Let's create a little ambiance. Hanukkah, of course, it's a gibbous moon. And there was a virgin snow. The fresh skein of powder had just dusted down. And there's this rosy luminosity bouncing off from the gas lanterns on the white snow. And the girls traipsed off with their mothers, the prickly sensation in the chest from the cold. And the windows of the dressmaker shop were all cloudy from the vapor of the little girl's breath. And there's a Chanukiah menorah in the window beckoning everyone to enter. And our heroine gets up. I can take the drama no longer. Her name is Sarah Schneer. I thought you'd fall off your chairs. She gets up and she tells these Chassidish Maidlach the story of Chanukah. They can't believe it. They've never heard a story like this before. What a raconteur. And then she asked them, would you like to learn more? Yes. Then come back tomorrow. That night, our anniversary tonight, Sarshner entered into her diary, I'm starting a movement. I hope to impress these little souls, and who knows what difference it will make. We're going to end the story, and we know the difference. And they came the next night, and the next night, and after Chanukah, she set up a school in the afternoon, for 4 girls, then 9 girls, 11 girls, 12 girls, 14 girls. When it reached 16, she made it a full day school and removed the sewing machine and the bolts of fabric and the scissors. All that remained was the blackboard, previously had been used for dimensions and figures, and now is used for block letters, Aleph, Beis, Gimel. There was a Roman Vishniak was that photographer which captured the images in the interbellum period between the world wars. And there's a picture of a woman with a tichel pulled tightly over her head, an elderly woman holding a large tome, a large volume. And around her, all these little girls looking starry-eyed in every direction. The Rashi, as I understand it, the explanation of this picture is, she's reading to them Senerena, but the girls are illiterate. They're expected to daven by heart and learn by heart and bench by heart. Now she has this very ambitious plan to set up a school for girls, but her brother is appalled. You can't teach girls Torah, it's unthinkable. And he can't dissuade her. And everything he tries is to no avail, and he realizes he'll pull out the stops, he'll take it before the Belzer Rebbe. And he says to her, Sarala, listen here, it's not appropriate, it's incorrect, and it's wrong. We'll go to the Rebbe, he'll set you straight. Okay. So he goes to visit her brother, and he says, come on, Sarala, the Rebbe is a very busy man. Why waste his time on something so insignificant and tertiary and moronic and imbecilic and idiotic? But he can't dissuade her. So he takes her to the Rebbe, and the whole time he's cringing. Please, don't waste his time. Now, the Belzer Rebbe was famous for his brevity. You ask him a very important question, he'd answer, or, if it was significant, maybe life-impending, life-critical to life, he might say, yeah. Or name. And she writes out on a tzetel, a long piece of paper, what she intends about starting a school and maybe even a network. And he reads it, and the whole time her brother's cringing, no, no. And when he finishes, he says enthusiastically, Hatzluchu Brucha, blessing and success in your endeavor. For a man who's spoken telegrams, this is a 500-page essay. Her brother almost falls on his head. She now has the endorsement of the Belzer Rebbe. Next stop is a man who's critically important for education in Poland, and that's the Gerebbe. She goes before the Gerebbe, whose sister lives in Krakow, and she told her brother, you must endorse what this woman is doing. This woman is going to save our people. And he gives his endorsement. And the next, now, when the Chafetz Chaim, who lived in Rabin, heard that the Gerebbe has endorsed women learning Torah, which seemingly violates that which the Talmud teaches, Gemara in Sota, come alam is beat the Tarkila linda tiflus. If you teach your daughter Torah as if you taught them something wholly inappropriate, the Chafetz Chaim said to his Talmud, I'm going to travel to Ger. He was already in his 80s, and that was a fluke. And those days, the average age was in their young 40s. Fulfilling the moniker Misha Chafetz Chaim, one who is the one who desires life and guards his tongue from slander. And they made a wagon with cushions, the mattresses atop it, and then more cushions. And he got onto the wagon, he said, I'm going to travel a three-day journey. Every day I want you to recite Tillim, that the Gerebbe should change his mind, and on the third day, I ask you to fast, the Gerebbe should stop and rescind his endorsement. And he clippity-clopped all the way to Ger. And let's not forget for one second, Chafetz Chaim is the Isha Emes, the man of ultimate truth. And Gerebbe tells him, you're making a mistake. Chafetz Chaim wrote in his classic letter of endorsement, all they're teaching girls today is tiflus. If only they would teach them Torah. She now has the Belzer Rebbe, the Gerebbe, the Chafetz Chaim. The next stop is Vegas. Man. But it's not wall-to-wall support. When she walks in the streets, Munkach is opposed, Slotim is opposed, they pelt rocks at her and her students. And when they throw rocks at her, you know what she does? She bends down, lifts up the rocks, and no, she doesn't do that either. She bends down, and she lifts up the rocks and places them in her palm, and she caresses them. And that's genius. She says, we're going to take these slung stones and turn them into bricks to build Beis Yaakov. That's Jews taking opposition into a matter of strength. She becomes an unstoppable force. Shuls all across the country open up the doors to her. And many times there are men there, and she points the finger of accusation. You're so busy in your business, you've neglected your daughters. And one of two reactions. Either they say, no, just a bunch of girls. Or they nod in agreement. They break down crying. And she goes across the country. And she starts a school. And the way it was that if you want your daughter to be religious, basically you had no other recourse but to send her to Krakow and Sarashner. Now I know if you send your daughters to Israel to seminary, that's a far more lengthy journey than to go from Paris or Vilna or Kovna to Krakow, but only geographically. In Paris, they had homes with parquet floors and paneled walls. And they travel to Krakow where the floors are dirt. And the walls are flimsy curtains. And society has not changed in 500 years. Same gas lanterns, horse and buggies. By the way, we're almost finished. And yet, they realize they had no other option. Okay, we'll start again. Yes, it's the easiest. Okay, I like more of moving around. So now, these girls, and we're talking about young girls, 11 years old, 12 years old, and if a girl would get accepted to the seminary, it was such a simcha for the congregation, for that community. They made her a Sudas Preda, and they would all escort her to the train station. And this young girl felt so good. She's representing so many others. But as the train would advance, chugga, 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 chugga. When she arrived in Krakow, the dam was about to burst. No cell phones. Like I told you before, you send your daughters a longer journey. But when they leave on their journey to Eretz Yisrael, they have a cell phone, and they're speaking in English in the airport and on the plane, and they're always speaking in English. But when these girls arrive in Krakow, it's a whole different world. And there's no phone to call home, and they won't see home for the longest time. But Mama Sara is there, she was referred to, and it's very interesting. A young woman that was married and divorced at a young age and never had any children, and yet her title is Ein B'Yisrael, the mother of our people. And somehow she took them under her wing, and the girls felt like they've come home. But with the school growing and growing, in the blink of an eye it went from nothing to 38,000 in Poland, an equal number across the continent.
And it was a one-man show. She had to prepare the lessons, and she'd never studied anything except for what she learned from Rabbi Dr. Moshe Fleisch, create a curriculum. She had to write everything by pen. There was no Xerox machine. I was going to say stencil, but didn't want to date myself. And she had to raise the money and recruit the students all across the country. And if she's in the class all day long, what about the girls in Katowice, Lublin, Lodz, Warsaw, in Auschwitz, and in Auschwitz? There's 800 girls. And she'd go and recruit. But when the school reached 320, it was just too much to abandon a school irresponsible. She had no other recourse but to matriculate her graduates, and they were 12, 13, 14 years old, to put their hairs up in updos, put on high heels, mature expressions. They came in the classroom, and it worked. The first cadre of leaders. Okay, our time is lapsing, so we'll end the story. Whenever she'd go on one of her trips on the road, she'd take along a student, and she would tweak her the whole way, teaching her a lesson. And part of the curriculum was that you could not be graduated until you spent 6 months in the field, establishing a new school or enhancing a school. Now, the school was located in the tenements of Krakow, adjacent to a tannery. Tanneries where they work on hides, which are so malodorous and odorific and verstunken and redolent, that the Gemara says that a woman married to a tanner is entitled to a divorce. You can't be expected to live with a man who's so verstunken. So in the winter, okay, the windows are closed, but in the summer when the heat is so intense, there is no way that she can have the school there in the tenements of Krakow. And they moved to the meadows of Poland, and she knew her weakness. She was able to teach, but she was never taught pedagogic skills, and there was no way she could bring experts from Vienna and Frankfurt to the tenements of Krakow, but indeed she could to the Dacha area of the meadows of Poland. And every girl would recharge themselves in the summer. They would go from Shavuos time up until Yom Kippur. And when Yom Kippur was over, they danced. They danced and they danced and they danced and they danced until 3 a.m. And finally they made Havdalah, and that gave them the koach to keep on going. And she realized it was a noxious environment in Poland. It's not enough to have them in school, but the whole environment was one that was indeed so noxious. So she created B'nos groups. And these pictures are so unbelievably adorable. I have in one of my books pictures where you see girls like this, where the leader is maybe 13 years old, the girls are 9 and 10 years old. And these pictures went up on the mantelpiece, on the wall, in the purse, and many went on the final journey to the crematoria. She was invited to establish a Beis Yaakov in Israel, very excited by the opportunity. She wasn't feeling well. They could not diagnose in Krakow. She returned again to Vienna. They operated and discovered a terminal cancer about which they could do nothing. So Schneerz returned to Krakow. And the last Friday of her life, she beckoned that they bring her lichter, candlesticks. Her final gesticulation was the light, the flame. And she's peering at the candles, and her soul is summoned to yeshiva above. That image of Sarah will always stay, the Sarah looking at the fire. For that's indeed what she did. She lit a fire, burning brightly in this room, unless you think it's only the domain of Beis Yaakov. Said Rav Aaron Cutler, and the Panovich Rav, we wouldn't be here today. And there wouldn't be yeshivas, and there wouldn't be kollels, if not for what this woman did. It all started on this very night, the first night of Hanukkah. She entered into a diary, and that was the kickoff of the Beis Yaakov movement. Okay, and that is what I have to say. I just want to repeat the way we began. We're here to celebrate this phenomenal Makom Torah here in your midst. I hope you're all taking advantage. If I would be here, I would. So if I would do it, how much more so everyone else? We're here tonight to support the Kollel. So very parenthetic, I want to mention in the back, I have some books and CDs. I think you'll find them enriching. I know I will. And we have a special tonight, which you'll find very worthwhile. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
I said 40 to 45. I said 35 to 45.
It's all of Thursday.
An hour. Usually it's just half as long. I don't want to check.
Don't worry, I've been there with you.
Okay. It's
anniversary.
Okay.
I don't know what time. I showed up here.
Let's see how long it went.
How long? Okay, that doesn't mean it's a chicken.
What?
No, it starts after.
No, it's 25 minutes. It's about 25 minutes.